New York City, March 13th, 2014. 8. The bookshop is busier today. A kid plays hide-and-seek with his imaginary friend while his father turns through a military history. A college student crouches, scanning the different editions of Blake, and the boy she met yesterday stands behind the counter. She studies him, the habit like thumbing through a book. His black hair tumbles forward into his eyes, unruly, untamable. He pushes it back, but in seconds it has fallen forward again, making him look younger than he is. He has the kind of face, she thinks, that can't keep secrets well. There is a short queue, so Addie hangs back between poetry and memoir. She wraps her nails along a shelf, and a few moments later an orange head pokes itself out from the dark above the spines. She pets book absently and waits for the queue to thin from 3 to 2 to 1. The boy, Henry, notices her lingering nearby, and something crosses his face, too fast for even her to read, before his attention flicks back to the woman at the counter. "Yes, Miss Klein," he's saying. "No, that's fine. And if it's not what he wants, just bring it back." The woman toddles off, clutching her store bag, and Addie steps up. "Hi there," she says brightly. "Hello," Henry says, an edge of caution in his voice. "Can I help you?"
"I hope so," she says, all practiced charm. She sets the Odyssey on the counter between them. "My friend bought me this book, but I already have it. I was hoping I could exchange it for something else."
He studies her. A dark brow lifts behind his glasses. "Are you serious?"
"I know," she says with a laugh. "Hard to believe I already own this one in Greek, but..."
He rocks back on his heels.
"You are serious."
Addie falters, thrown off by the edge in his voice.
"I just thought it was worth asking.
This isn't a library," he chides. "You can't just trade one book for another."
Addie straightens.
"Obviously," she says, a little indignant. "But like I said, I didn't buy it. My friend did, and I just heard you tell Miss Klein that..."
His face hardens, the flat regard of a door slammed shut.
"Word of advice, next time you try to return a book, don't return it to the same person you stole it from the first time."
A rock drops inside her chest.
"What?"
He shakes his head.
"You were just in here yesterday."
"I wasn't. I remember you."
Three words, large enough to tip the world. "I remember you." Addie lurches as if struck, about to fall. She tries to right herself.
"No, you don't," she says firmly.
His green eyes narrow.
"Yes, I do. You came in here yesterday, green sweater, black jeans. You stole this used copy of the Odyssey, which I gave back to you because who steals a used copy of the Odyssey in Greek anyways? And then you have the nerve to come back in here and try to trade it out for something else when you didn't even buy the first one?"
Addie closes her eyes, vision swimming. She doesn't understand. She can't.
"Now look," he says. "I think you better go."
She opens her eyes and sees him pointing to the door. Her feet won't move. They refuse to carry her away from those three words. "I remember you." 300 years. 300 years, and no one has said those words. No one has ever, ever remembered. She wants to grab him by the sleeve, wants to pull him forward, wants to know why, how, what is so special about a boy in a bookstore. But the man with the military history is waiting to pay, the kid clinging to his leg, and the boy with the glasses is glaring at her, and this is all wrong. She grips the counter, feels like she might faint. His eyes soften just a fraction.
"Please," he says under his breath. "Just go."
She tries. She can't. Addie gets as far as the open door, the four short steps from the shop to the street, before something in her gives. She slumps onto the lip at the top of the stairs, puts her head in her hands, feels like she might cry or laugh, but instead, she stares back through the beveled glass insert of the shop door. She watches the boy every time he comes into the frame. She cannot tear her eyes away.
"I remember you. I remember you.
I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember you. I remember.
What are you doing? She blinks and sees him standing in the open doorway, arms crossed. The sun has shifted lower in the sky, the light going thin.
Waiting for you, she says, cringing as soon as she says it. I wanted to apologize, she continues, for the whole book thing.
It's fine, he says curtly.
No, it's not, she says, rising to her feet. Let me buy you a coffee.
You don't have to do that.
I insist, as an apology.
I'm working.
Please.
And it must be something in the way she says it, the sheer mix of hope and need, the obvious fact it means more than a book, more than a sorry, that makes the boy look her in the eyes, makes her realize that he hadn't really, not until now. There's something strange, searching in his gaze, but whatever he sees when he looks at her, it changes his mind. One coffee, he says, and you're still banned from the shop. Addie feels the air rush back into her lungs.
Deal.
New York City, March 13th, 2014. 9. Addie lingers on the bookstore steps for an hour until it closes. Henry locks up and turns to see her sitting there, and Addie braces again for the blankness in his gaze, the confirmation that their earlier encounter was only some strange glitch, a slipped stitch in the centuries of her curse. But when he looks at her, he knows her. She is certain he knows her. His brows go up beneath his tangled curls, as if he's surprised that she's still there. But his annoyance has given way to something else, something that confuses her even more. It's less hostile than suspicion, more guarded than relief, and it is still wonderful because of the knowing in it. Not a first meeting, but a second, or rather a third, and for once she is not the only one who knows. Well, he says, holding out his hand, not for her to take, but for her to lead the way, and she does. They walk a few blocks in awkward silence, Addie stealing glances that tell her nothing but the line of his nose, the angle of his jaw. He has a starved look, wolfish and lean, and even though he's not unnaturally tall, he hunches his shoulders as if to make himself shorter, smaller, less obtrusive. Perhaps in the right clothes, perhaps with the right air, perhaps. But the longer she looks at him, the weaker the resemblance to that other stranger. And yet, there is something about him that keeps catching her attention, snagging it the way a nail snags a sweater. Twice he catches her looking at him and frowns. Once she catches him stealing his own glance and smiles. At the coffee shop, she tells him to grab a table while she buys the drinks, and he hesitates, as if torn between the urge to pay and the fear of being poisoned, before retreating to a corner booth. She orders him a latte. $3.80, says the girl behind the counter. Addie cringes at the cost. She pulls a few bills from her pocket, the last of what she took from James St. Clair. She doesn't have the cash for two drinks, and she can't just walk out with them because there's a boy waiting. And he remembers. Addie glances toward the table, where he sits, arms folded, staring out the window.
Eve,
calls the barista.
Eve!
Addie startles, realizing that means her.
So, says the boy when she sits down. Eve?
No, she thinks. Yeah, she says. And you're... Henry, she thinks, just before he says it. Henry. It fits him like a coat. Henry, soft, poetic. Henry, quiet, strong. The black curls, the pale eyes behind their heavy frames. She has known a dozen Henrys in London, Paris, Boston, and LA, but he is not like any of them. His gaze drops to the table, his cup, her empty hands.
You didn't get anything?
She waves it away. I'm not really thirsty, she lies.
It feels weird.
Why? She shrugs.
I said I'd buy you a coffee. Besides, she hesitates. I lost my wallet. I didn't have enough for two. Henry frowns.
Is that why you stole the book?
I didn't steal it. I wanted to trade. And I said sorry.
Did you?
With the coffee.
Speaking of, he says, standing, how do you take it?
What?
The coffee. I can't sit here and drink alone. It makes me feel like an asshole.
She smiles. Hot chocolate. Dark. Those brows quirk up again. He walks away to order, says something that makes the barista laugh and lean forward like a flower to the sun. He returns with a second cup and a croissant and sets them both in front of her before taking his seat, and now they are uneven again. Balance tipped, restored, and tipped again, and it is the kind of game she's played 100 times, a sparring match made of small gestures, the stranger smiling across the table. But this is not her stranger, and he is not smiling.
So, says Henry, what was all that today with the book?
Honestly, Addie wraps her hands around the coffee cup.
I didn't think you'd remember.
The question rattles like loose change in her chest, like pebbles in a porcelain bowl. It shakes inside her, threatening to spill out. How did you remember? How?
The last word doesn't get that many customers, Henry says, and even fewer try to leave without paying. I guess you made an impression.
An impression. An impression is like a mark. Addie runs her fingers through the foam on her hot chocolate, watches the milk smooth again in her wake. Henry doesn't notice, but he noticed her. He remembered. What is happening?
So, he says, but the sentence goes nowhere.
So, she echoes, because she cannot say what she wants.
Tell me about yourself.
Who are you? Why are you? What is happening? Henry bites his lip and says,
not much to tell.
Did you always want to work in a bookshop? Henry's face turns wistful.
I'm not sure it's the job that people dream of, but I like it.
He's lifting the latte to his mouth when someone shuffles past, knocking against his chair. Henry writes the cup in time, but the man begins to apologize and doesn't stop.
Hey, I'm so sorry.
His face twists with guilt.
It's fine. Did I make you spill?
Asks the man with genuine concern.
Nope, says Henry. You're good.
If he registers the man's intensity, he gives no sign. His focus stays firmly on Addie, as if he can will the man away.
That was weird, she says when he's finally gone.
Henry only shrugs.
Accidents happen.
That isn't what she meant, but the thoughts are passing trains, and she can't afford to be derailed. So, she says, the bookshop, is it yours? Henry shakes his head.
No. I mean, it might as well be. I'm the only employee. But it belongs to a woman named Meredith, who spends most of her time on cruises. I just work there. What about you? What do you do when you're not stealing books?
Addie weighs the question, the many possible answers, all of them lies, and settles for something closer to the truth.
I'm a talent scout, she says. Music, mostly, but also art.
Henry's face hardens.
You should meet my sister.
Oh? Asks Addie, wishing she'd lied. Is she an artist?
I think she'd say she fosters art, that it's a type of artist, maybe. She likes to...
He makes a flourish.
Nurture the raw potential, shape the narrative of the creative future.
Addie thinks she would like to meet his sister, but she doesn't say it.
Do you have siblings? He asks.
She shakes her head, tearing a corner off the croissant because he hasn't touched it and her stomach's growling.
Lucky, he says.
Lonely, she counters.
Well, you're welcome to mine. There's David, who's a doctor, a scholar, and a pretentious asshole, and Muriel, who's, well, Muriel.
He looks at her, and there it is again, that strange intensity. And maybe it's just that so few people make eye contact in the city, but she can't shake the feeling he's looking for something in her face.
What is it? She asks, and he starts to say one thing, but changes course.
Your freckles look like stars.
Addie smiles.
I've heard. My own little constellation. It's the first thing everyone sees.
Henry shifts in his seat.
What do you see, he says, when you look at me?
His voice is light enough, but there is something in the question, a weight, like a stone buried in a snowball. He's been waiting to ask. The answer matters.
I see a boy with dark hair and kind eyes and an open face.
He frowns a little.
Is that all?
Of course not, she says. But I don't know you yet.
Yet,
he echoes, and there's something like a smile in his voice. She purses her lips, considers him again. For a moment, they are the only silent spot in the bustling cafe. Live long enough, and you learn how to read a person, to ease them open like a book, some passages underlined and others hidden between the lines. Addie scans his face, the slight furrow where his brows go in and up, the set of his lips, the way he rubs one palm as if working out an ache, even as he leans forward and in, his attention wholly on her.
I see someone who cares, she says slowly. Perhaps too much. Who feels too much. I see someone lost and hungry. The kind of person who feels like they're wasting away in a world full of food because they can't decide what they want.
Henry stares at her, all the humor gone out of his face, and she knows she's gotten too close to the truth. Addie laughs nervously, and the sound rushes back in around them.
Sorry, she says, shaking her head. Too deep. I probably should have just said you were good-looking.
Henry's mouth quirks, but the smile doesn't reach his eyes.
At least you think I'm good-looking.
What about me? She asks, trying to break the sudden tension. But for the first time, Henry won't look her in the eyes.
I've never been good at reading people.
He nudges the cup away and stands, and Addie thinks she's ruined it. He's leaving. But then he looks down at her and says,
I'm hungry. Are you hungry?
And the air rushes back into her lungs.
Always, she says.
And this time, when he holds out his hand, she knows he's inviting her to take it. Paris, France, July 29th, 1719. 10. Addie has discovered chocolate. Harder to come by than salt or champagne or silver, and yet the Marchioness keeps an entire tin of the dark, sweet flakes beside her bed. Addie wonders, as she holds a melting sliver on her tongue, if the woman counts the pieces every night, or if she only notices when her fingers skim the empty bottom of the tin. She is not home to ask. If she were, Addie wouldn't be sprawled atop her down duvet. But Addie and the lady of the house have never met. Hopefully, they never will. The Marquis and his wife keep quite a social calendar, after all, and over the last few years, their city house has become one of her favorite haunts. Haunt. It is the right word for someone living like a ghost. Twice a week, they have friends to dinner in their city house, and every fortnight they host a grander party there, and once a month, which happens to be tonight, they take a carriage across Paris to play cards with other noble families, and do not return until the early morning. By now, the servants have retreated to their own quarters, no doubt to drink and savor their small measure of freedom. They will take shifts so that at any given time a single sentinel stands watch at the base of the stairs while the rest enjoy their peace. Perhaps they play cards too, or perhaps they simply relish the quiet of an empty house. Addie rests another bit of chocolate on her tongue and sinks back onto the Marchioness's bed into the cloud of airy down. There are more cushions here than in all of Villon, she is certain, and each is twice as full of feathers. Apparently, nobles are made of glass, designed to break if laid upon too rough a surface. Addie spreads her arms, like a child making angels in the snow, and sighs with pleasure. She spent an hour or so combing over and through the Marchioness's many dresses, but she doesn't have enough hands to climb into any of them, so she has wrapped herself in a blue silk dressing gown finer than anything she's ever owned. Her own dress, a rust-colored thing with a cream lace trim, lies abandoned on the chaise, and when she looks at it, she remembers the wedding gown, cast off in the grass along the salt, the pale white linen shed like a skin beside her. The memory clings like spider silk. Addie pulls the dressing gown close, inhales the scent of roses on the hem, closes her eyes, and imagines this is her bed, her life, and for a few minutes it is pleasant enough. But the room is too warm, too still, and she's afraid if she lingers in the bed it might swallow her. Or worse, she might fall asleep and find herself shaken awake by the lady of the house, and what a pain that would be, since the bedroom is on the second floor. It takes a full minute to climb out of the bed, hands and knees sinking into the down as she scrambles toward the edge, tumbles gracelessly onto the rug. She steadies herself against a wooden post, delicate branches carved into the oak, thinks of trees as she surveys the room, deciding how to occupy herself. A glass door leads out onto the balcony, a wooden one leads into the hall, a chest of drawers, a chaise, a dressing table topped by a polished mirror. Addie sinks onto a cushioned stool before the vanity, her fingers dancing over the bottles of perfume and pots of cream, the soft plume of a powder puff, a bowl of silver hairpins. Of these last, she takes a handful and begins to twist up locks of hair, fastening the coils back and up around her face as if she has the faintest idea what she is doing. The current style is reminiscent of a sparrow's nest, a bundle of curls. At least she is not yet expected to wear a wig, one of those monstrous powdered things like towers of meringue that will come into fashion 50 years from now. Her nest of curls is set, but needs a final touch. Addie lifts a pearl comb in the shape of a feather and slides the teeth into the locks just behind her ear. Strange, the way small differences add up. Perched there on the pillowed seat, surrounded by luxury, in her borrowed blue silk robe with her hair pinned up in curls, Addie could almost forget herself, could almost be someone else. A young mistress, the lady of the house, able to move freely with the safeguard of her reputation. Only the freckles on her cheeks stand out, a reminder of who Addie was, is, will always be. But freckles are easily covered. She takes up the powder puff, the bloom halfway to her cheek, when a faint breeze stirs the air, carrying the scent not of Paris, but open fields, and a low voice says, "I would rather see clouds blot out the stars." Addie's gaze cuts to the mirror and the reflection of the room behind her. The balcony doors are still shut fast, but the chamber is no longer empty. The shadow leans against the wall with all the ease of someone who has been there for a while. She is not surprised to see him. He has come year after year, but she is unsettled. She will always be unsettled. "Hello, Adeline," says the darkness, and though he is across the room, the words brush like leaves against her skin. She turns in her seat, free hand rising to the open collar of her robe. "Go away," he clicks his tongue.
"A year apart, and that is all you have to say?"
"No."
"What then?"
"I mean, no," she says again. "That is my answer to your question. The only reason you're here. You've come to ask if I will yield, and the answer is no."
His smile ripples, shifts. Gone is the gentleman, again the wolf.
"My Adeline, you've grown some teeth."
"I am not yours," she says.
A flash of warning white, and then the wolf retreats, pretends to be a man again as he steps into the light. And yet, the shadows cling to him, smudging edges into the dark.
"I grant you immortality, and you spend your evenings eating bonbons in other people's beds. I imagined more for you than this."
"And yet you condemned me to less. Come to gloat?"
He runs a hand along the wooden post, tracing the branches.
Such venom on our anniversary, and here I came only to offer you dinner.
I see no food, and I do not want your company.
He moves like smoke, one moment across the room and the next beside her.
I would not be so quick to scorn,
he says, one long finger grazing the pearl comb in her hair.
It is the only company you'll ever have.
Before she can pull away, the air is empty. He is across the room again, hand resting on the tassel beside the door.
Stop,
she says, lunging to her feet, but it's too late. He pulls, and a moment later the bell rings, splitting the silence of the house.
Damn you,
she hisses as footsteps sound on the stairs. Addie is already turning to take up her dress, to snag what little she can before she flees, but the darkness catches her arm. He forces her to stay there at his side like some misbehaving child as a lady's maid opens the door. She should startle at the sight of them, two strangers in her master's home, but there is no shock in the woman's face, no surprise, anger, or fear. There is nothing at all. Only a kind of vacancy, a calm unique to the dreaming and the dazed. The maid stands, head bowed and hands laced, waiting for instruction, and Addie realizes with dawning horror and relief that the woman is bewitched.
We will dine in the salon tonight,
says the darkness, as if the house were his. There is a new timbre to his voice, a film like gossamer drawn over stone. It ripples in the air, wraps itself around the maid, and Addie can feel it sliding along her own skin, even as it fails to hold.
Yes, sir,
says the maid with a small bow. She turns to lead them down the stairs, and the darkness looks to Addie and smiles.
Come,
he says, eyes gone emerald with arrogant glee.
I heard the Marquis's chef is one of the best in Paris.
He offers her his arm, but she does not take it.
You don't really expect me to dine with you.
He lifts his chin.
You would waste such a meal simply because I'm at the table. I think your stomach is louder than your pride. But suit yourself, my dear. Stay here in your borrowed room and glut yourself on stolen sweets. I'll eat without you.
With that, he strides away, and she is torn between the urge to slam the door behind him and the knowledge that her night is ruined, whether she eats with him or not, that even if she stays here in this room, her mind will follow him down the stairs to dinner. And so she goes. 7 years from now, Addie will see a puppet show being put on in a Paris square. A curtained cart with a man behind, hands raised to hold aloft the little wooden figures, their limbs dancing up and down with twine. And she will think of this night, this dinner. The servants of the house move around them as if on strings, smooth and silent, every gesture done with that same sleepy ease. Chairs pulled back, linen smoothed, bottles of champagne uncorked and poured into waiting crystal flutes. But the food comes out too quickly, the first course arriving as the glasses are filled. Whatever hold the darkness has on the servants of this house, it began before his entrance in her stolen room. It began before he rang the bell and called the maid and summoned her to dinner. He should seem so out of place in the filigreed room. He is, after all, a wild thing, a god of forest nights, a demon bounded by the dark, and yet he sits with the poise and grace of a nobleman enjoying his dinner. Addie fingers the silver cutlery, the gilt trim of the plates.
Am I supposed to be impressed?
The darkness looks at her across the table.
Are you not?
He asks as the servants bow and draw back against the walls. The truth is, she is scared, unsettled by the display. She knows his power, at least she thought she did, but it's one thing to make a deal and another to be the witness of such control. What could he make them do? How far could he make them go? Is it as easy for him as pulling strings? The first course is placed before her, a cream soup the pale orange of dawn. It smells wonderful, and the champagne sparkles in its glass, but she does not let herself reach for either.
The darkness reads the caution in her face.
Come, Adeline, he says. I am no fae thing here to trap you with food and drink.
And yet everything seems to have a price.
He exhales, eyes flashing a paler shade of green.
Suit yourself,
he says, taking up his glass and drinking deeply. After a long moment, Addie gives in and lifts the crystal to her lips, taking her first sip of champagne. It is unlike anything she's ever tasted. A thousand fragile bubbles race across her tongue, sweet and sharp, and she would melt with pleasure if it were any other table, any other man, any other night. Instead of savoring each sip, she immediately empties her glass, and by the time she sets it on the table, her head is fizzing slightly, and the servant is already at her elbow, pouring her a second drink. The darkness sips his own and watches, saying nothing as she eats. The silence in the room grows heavy, but she does not break it. Instead, she focuses first on the soup, and then on fish, and then on a round of pastry-crusted beef. It is more than she has eaten in months, in years, and she feels full in a way that goes beyond her stomach. And as she slows, she studies the man, who is not a man, across the table, the way the shadows bend in the room at his back. This is the longest they have ever spent together. Before, there were only those mere moments in the woods, the minutes in a shoddy room, half an hour along the Seine. But now, for the first time, he does not loom behind her like a shadow, does not linger like a phantom at the edges of her sight. Now he sits across from her, on full display, and though she knows the static details of his face, having drawn them 100 times, still, she cannot help but study him in motion. And he lets her. There is no shyness in his manner. He seems, if anything, to relish her attention. As his knife slices across the plate, as he lifts a bite of meat to his lips, his black brows lift, his mouth tugs at the corner. Less a man than a collection of features drawn by a careful hand. In time, that will change. He will inflate, expand to fill the gaps between the lines of her drawing, wrest the image from her grip until she cannot fathom that it was ever hers. But for now, the only aspect that is his, entirely his, are those eyes. She imagined them 100 times, and yes, they were always green, but in her dream, they were a single shade, the steady green of summer leaves. His are different. Startling, inconstant, the slightest change in humor, in temper, reflected there and only there. It will take Addie years to learn the language of those eyes, to know that amusement renders them the shade of summer ivy, while annoyance lightens them to sour apple, and pleasure darkens them to the almost black of the woods at night, only the edges still discernible as green. Tonight, they are the slippery color of weeds caught in the current of a stream. By the end of dinner, they will be another shade entirely. There is something languid in his posture. He sits there, one elbow on the tablecloth, his attention drifting, head tipped ever so slightly, as if listening to a far-off sound, while his elegant fingers trace the line of his chin as if amused by his own form, and before she knows it, she has broken the silence again.
What is your name?
His eyes slide from a corner of the room back to her.
Why must I have one?
All things have names, she says. Names of purpose. Names of power.
She tips her glass his way.
You know that, or else you wouldn't have stolen mine.
A smile tugs at the corner of his mouth, wolfish, amused.
If it is true, he says, that names have power, then why would I hand you mine?
Because I must call you something, to your face and in my head. And right now, I have only curses.
The darkness does not seem to care.
Call me whatever you like. It makes no difference. What did you call the stranger in your journals? The man after whom you fashioned me?
You fashioned yourself to mock me, and I would rather you take any other form.
You see violence in every gesture, he muses, running a thumb over his glass. I fashioned myself to suit you, to put you at ease.
Anger rises in her chest.
You have ruined the one thing I still had.
How sad that you had only dreams.
She resists the urge to fling the crystal at him, knowing it will do no good. Instead, she looks to the servant by the wall, holds out the glass for him to fill it. But the servant doesn't move. None of them do. They are bound to his will, not hers. And so she rises and takes the bottle up herself.
What was his name, your stranger?
She returns to her seat, refills her glass, focuses on the thousand shining bubbles that rise through the center.
He had no name, she says.
But it is a lie, of course, and the darkness looks at her as if he knows it. The truth is, she'd tried on a dozen names over the years, Michel and Jean, Nicolas, Henri, Vincent, and none of them had fit. And then, one night, there it was, tripping off her tongue when she was curled in bed, wrapped in the image of him beside her, long fingers trailing through her hair. The name had passed her lips, simple as breath, natural as air. Luc. In her mind, it stood for Lucien. But now, sitting across from this shadow, this charade, the irony is like a too-hot drink, an ember burning in her chest. Luc, as in Lucifer. The words echo through her, carried like a breeze. Am I the devil or the darkness? And she does not know, will never know, but the name is already ruined. Let him have it.
Luc, she murmurs.
The shadow smiles, a dazzling, cruel imitation of joy, and lifts his drink as if to toast.
Then Luc it is.
Addie drains her glass again, clinging to the lightheadedness it brings. The effects won't last, of course. She can feel her senses fighting back with every empty glass, but she presses on, determined to best them, at least for a while.
I hate you, she says.
Oh, Adeline, he says, setting down his glass. Without me, where would you be?
As he speaks, he turns the crystal stem between his fingers, and in its faceted reflection, she sees another life, her own and not her own, a version where Adeline didn't run to the woods as the sun went down and the wedding party gathered, didn't summon the darkness to set her free. In the glass, she sees herself, her old self, the one she might have been, Roger's children at her side, and a new baby on her hip, and her familiar face gone sallow with fatigue. Addie sees herself beside him in the bed, the space cold between their bodies, sees herself bent over the hearth the way her mother always was, the same frown lines, too, fingers aching too much to stitch the tears in clothes, far too much to hold her old drawing pencils. Sees herself wither on the vine of life and walk the short step so familiar to every person in Villon, the narrow road from cradle to grave, the little church waiting, still and gray as a tombstone. Addie sees it, and she is grateful he doesn't ask if she would go back, trade this for that, because for all the grief and the madness, the loss, the hunger and the pain, she still recoils from the image in the glass. The meal is done, and the servants of the house stand in the shadows, waiting for their master's next instruction. And though their heads are bowed and their faces are blank, she cannot help but think of them as hostages.
I wish you would send them away.
You are out of wishes, he says.
But Addie meets his eyes and holds them. It is easier, now that he has a name, to think of him as a man, and men can be challenged. And after a moment, the darkness sighs and turns to the nearest servant and tells them to open a bottle for themselves and go. And now they are alone, and the room seems smaller than it was before.
There, says Luc.
When the Marquis and his wife come home and find their servants drunk, they will suffer for it.
And who will be blamed, I wonder, for the missing chocolates in the ladies' room, or the blue silk robe? Do you think no one suffers when you steal?
Addie bristles, heat rising to her cheeks.
You gave me no choice.
I gave you what you asked for, Adeline. Time without constraint. Life without restriction.
You cursed me to be forgotten.
You asked for freedom. There is no greater freedom than that. You can move through the world unhindered, untethered, unbound.
Stop pretending you did me a kindness instead of a cruelty.
I did you a deal.
His hand comes down hard on the table as he says it, annoyance flashing yellow in his eyes, brief as lightning.
You came to me. You pleaded. You begged. You chose the words. I chose the terms. There is no going back. But if you have already tired of going forward, you need only say the words.
And there it is again, the hatred. So much easier to hold on to.
It was a mistake to curse me.
Her tongue is coming loose, and she doesn't know if it's the champagne or simply the duration of his presence, the acclimation that comes with time, like a body adjusting to a too-hot bath.
If you had only given me what I asked for, I would have burned out in time, would have had my feel of living, and we would, both of us, have won. But now, no matter how tired I am, I will never give you this soul.
He smiles.
You are a stubborn thing, but even rocks wear away to nothing.
Addie sits forward.
You think yourself a cat playing with its catch, but I am not a mouse, and I will not be a meal.
I do hope not.
He spreads his hands.
It's been so long since I had a challenge.
A game. To him, everything is a game.
You underestimate me.
Do I?
One black brow lifts as he sips his drink.
I suppose we'll see.
Yes, says Addie, taking up her own. We will.
He has given her a gift tonight, though she doubts he knows it. Time has no face, no form, nothing to fight against. But in his mocking smile, his toying words, the darkness has given her the one thing she truly needs, an enemy. It is here the battle lines are drawn. The first shot may have been fired back in Villon when he stole her life along with her soul, but this is the beginning of the war. New York City, March 13th, 2014. 11. She follows Henry to a bar that's too crowded, too loud. All the bars in Brooklyn are like that. Too little space for too many bodies, and the Merchant is apparently no exception, even on a Thursday. Addie and Henry are crammed into a narrow patio out back, bundled together under an awning, but she still has to lean in to hear his voice over the noise.
Where are you from? She starts.
Upstate, Newburgh. You?
Villon-sur-Sarthe, she says.
The words ache a little in her throat.
France? You don't have an accent.
I moved around.
They are sharing an order of fries and a pair of happy hour beers because, he explains, a bookstore job doesn't pay that well. Addie wishes she could go back in and fetch them some proper drinks, but she's already told him the lie about the wallet and she doesn't want to pull any more tricks, not after the Odyssey. Plus, she's afraid. Afraid to let him walk away. Afraid to let him out of sight. Whatever this is, a blip, a mistake, a beautiful dream, or a piece of impossible luck, she's afraid to let it go. Let him go. One wrong step and she'll wake up. One wrong step and the thread will snap, the curse will shudder back into place and it will be over, and Henry will be gone and she will be alone again. She forces herself back into the present. Enjoy it while it lasts. It cannot last, but right here, right now.
Penny for your thoughts,
he calls over the crowd. She smiles.
I can't wait for summer.
It's not a lie.
It has been a long, damp spring, and she is tired of being cold. Summer means hot days and nights where the light lingers. Summer means another year alive, another year without...
If you could have one thing, cuts in Henry, what would it be?
He studies her, squinting at her as if she's a book, not a person, something to be read. She stares back at him like he's a ghost, a miracle, an impossible thing. This, she thinks, but she lifts her empty glass and says,
another beer.
12. Addie can account for every second of her life, but that night with Henry, the moments seem to bleed together. Time slides by as they bounce from bar to bar, happy hour giving way to dinner, and then to late night drinks, and every time they hit the point where the evening splits and one road leads their separate ways and the other carries on ahead, they choose the second road. They stay together, each waiting for the other to say, it's getting late, or I should be going, or see you around. There is some unspoken pact, an unwillingness to sever whatever this is, and she knows why she's afraid to break the thread, but she wonders about Henry, wonders at the loneliness she sees behind his eyes, wonders at the way the waiters and the bartenders and the other patrons look at him, the warmth he doesn't seem to notice. And then it is almost midnight, and they are eating cheap pizza, walking side by side through the first warm night of spring as the clouds stretch overhead, low and lit by the moon. She looks up, and so does Henry, and for a moment, only a moment, he looks overwhelmingly, unbearably sad.
I miss the stars, he says.
So do I, she says, and his gaze drops back to her, and he smiles.
Who are you?
His eyes have gone glassy, and the way he says who almost sounds like how. Less a question of how she's doing, and more a question of how she's here. And she wants to ask him the same thing, but she has a good reason, and he's just a little drunk. And simply, perfectly normal. But he can't be normal, because normal people don't remember her. They've reached the subway. Henry stops.
This is me.
His hand slips free of hers, and there it is, that old familiar fear of endings, of something giving way to nothing, of moments unwritten and memories erased. She doesn't want the night to end, doesn't want the spell to break, doesn't...
I want to see you again,
says Henry. The hope fills her chest until it hurts. She's heard those words 100 times, but for the first time, they feel real, possible.
I want you to see me again, too.
Henry smiles, the kind of smile that takes over an entire face. He pulls out his cell, and Addie's heart sinks. She tells him that her phone is broken, when the truth is, she's never needed one before. Even if she had someone to call, she could not call them. Her fingers would slip uselessly over the screen. She has no email either, no way to send a message of any kind, thanks to the whole thou shalt not write part of her curse.
I didn't know you could exist these days without one.
Old-fashioned, she says. He offers to come by her place the next day. Where does she live? And it feels as if the universe is mocking her now.
I am staying at a friend's while they're out of town, she says. Why don't I meet you at the store?
Henry nods.
The store, then, he says, backing away. Saturday?
Saturday.
Don't go disappearing.
Addie laughs, a small, brittle thing. And then he's walking away. He's got a foot down the first step, and the panic grips her.
Wait, she says, calling him back. I need to tell you something.
Oh, God, Henry groans. You're with someone.
The ring burns in her pocket.
No.
You're in the CIA and you leave for a top secret mission tomorrow.
Addie laughs.
No.
You're...
My real name isn't Eve.
He pulls back, confused.
Okay.
She doesn't know if she can say it, if the curse will let her, but she has to try.
I didn't tell you my real name because, well, it's complicated. But I like you, and I want you to know, to hear it from me.
Henry straightens, sobering.
Well then, what is it?
The sound lodges for just a second, the stiffness of a muscle long since fallen to disuse, a rusty cog, and then it scrapes free.
Addie. She swallows, hard. My name's Addie.
It hangs in the air between them, and then Henry smiles.
Well, okay,
he says. Good night, Addie. As simple as that. Two syllables falling from a tongue, and it's the best sound she's ever heard. She wants to throw her arms around him, wants to hear it again and again, the impossible word filling her like air, making her feel solid, real.
Good night, Henry,
Addie says, willing him to turn and go because she doesn't think she can bring herself to turn away from him. She stands there, rooted to the spot at the top of the subway steps until he's out of sight, holds her breath, and waits to feel the threads snap, the world shudder back into shape, waits for the fear and the loss and the knowledge that it was just a fluke, a cosmic error, a mistake, that it is over now, that it will never happen again. But she doesn't feel any of those things. All she feels is joy and hope. Her boot heels tap out a rhythm on the street, and even after all these years, she half expects a second pair of shoes to fall in step beside her own, to hear the rolling fog of his voice, soft and sweet and mocking. But there is no shadow at her side, not tonight. The evening is quiet, and she is alone, but for once, it is not the same as being lonely. Good night, Addie. Henry said, and Addie cannot help but wonder if he has somehow broken the spell. She smiles and whispers to herself, good night, Ad. But the curse closes around her throat, the name lodging there as it always has. And yet, good night, Addie. 300 years she's tested the confines of her deal, found the places where it gives, the subtle bend and flex around the bars, but never a way out. And yet, somehow, impossibly, Henry has found a way in. Somehow he remembers her. How? How? The question thuds with the drum of her heart, but in this moment, Addie does not care. In this moment, she is holding to the sound of her name, her real name, on someone else's tongue. And it is enough. It is enough. It is enough.
Paris, France. July 29th, 1720. 13. The stage is set. The place is ready. Addie smooths the linen on the table, arranges the porcelain plates, the cups, not crystal but still glass, and draws the dinner from its hamper. It is no five-course meal, served by glamoured hands, but it is fresh and hearty fare. A loaf of bread still warm, a wedge of cheese, a pork terrine, a bottle of red wine. She is proud of her collection, prouder still of the fact she had no magic, save the curse, by which to gather it, could not simply cut her gaze, say a word, and will it so. It is not only the table, it is the room. No stolen chamber, no beggar's hovel. A place, for now at least, to call her own. It took 2 months to find, a fortnight to fix up, but it was worth it. From the outside, it is nothing. Cracked glass and warping wood. And it's true, the lower floors have fallen into disrepair, home now only to rodents and the occasional stray cats, and in winter, crowded with bodies seeking any form of shelter. But it is the height of summer now, and the city's poor have taken to the streets, and Addie has claimed the top floor for herself, boarded up the stairs and carved a way in and out through an upper window, like a child in a wooden fort.
It is an unconventional entrance, but it is worth it for the room beyond, where she has made herself a home. A bed, piled high with blankets, a chest filled with stolen clothes, the windowsill brims with trinkets, glass and porcelain and bone, gathered and assembled like a line of makeshift birds. In the middle of the narrow room, a pair of chairs sat before a table covered in pale linen, and in its center, a bundle of flowers, picked in the night from a royal garden and smuggled out in the folds of her skirt. And Addie knows none of it will last, it never does. A breeze will somehow steal away the totems on her mantle, there will be a fire or a flood, the floor will give way, or the secret home will be found and claimed by someone else. But she has guarded the pieces this past month, gathered and arranged them one by one to make a semblance of a life, and if she's being honest, it is not only for herself, it is for the darkness. It is for Luke. Or rather, it is to spite him, to prove that she is living, she is free, that Addie will give him no hold, no way to mock her with his charity. The first round was his, but the second will be hers. And so she has made her home and readied it for company, fastened up her hair and dressed herself in russet silk the color of fall leaves, even cinched herself into a corset despite her loathing of bone stays. She has had a year to plan, to design the postures she will strike, and as she straightens up the room, she turns barbs over in her mind, sharpening the weapons of their discourse. She imagines his thrusts and her parries, the way his eyes will lighten or darken as the conversation turns. "You have grown teeth," he said, and Addie will show him how sharp they have become. The sun has gone down now, and all that's left to do is wait. An hour passes, and her stomach growls with want as the bread goes cold in its cloth, but she doesn't allow herself to eat. Instead, she leans out the window and watches the city, the shifting lights of lanterns being lit. And he doesn't come. She pours herself a glass of wine and paces as the stolen candles drip and wax pools on the table linen and the night grows heavy, the hours first late and then early. And still, he doesn't come. The candles gutter and snuff themselves out, and Addie sits in the dark as the knowledge settles over her. The night has passed, the first threads of daylight creeping into the sky, and it is tomorrow now, and their anniversary is over, and 5 years have become 6 without his presence, without his face, without his asking if she's had enough. And the world slips because it is unfair, it is cheating, it is wrong. He was supposed to come, that was the nature of their dance. She did not want him there, has never wanted it, but she expected it. He has made her expect it, has given her a single threshold on which to balance, a narrow precipice of hope, because he is a hated thing, but a hated thing is still something, the only thing she has. And that is the point, of course. That is the reason for the empty glass, the barren plate, the unused chair. She gazes out the window and remembers the look in his eyes when they toasted, the curve of his lips when they declared war, and realizes what a fool she is, how easily baited. And suddenly, the whole tableau seems gruesome and pathetic, and Addie can't bear to look at it, can't breathe in her red silk. She tears at the laces of the corset, pulls the pins from her hair, frees herself from the confines of the dress, sweeps the settings from the table, and dashes the now empty bottle against the wall. Glass bites into her hand, and the pain is sharp and real, the sudden scald of a burn without the lasting scar, and she does not care. In moments, her cuts have already closed. The glasses and bottle lie whole. Once she thought it was a blessing, this inability to break, but now the impotence is maddening. She ruins everything, only to watch it shudder, mocking, back together, return like a set to the beginning of the show. And Addie screams. Anger flares inside her, hot and bright, anger at Luke and at herself, but it is giving way to fear and grief and terror because she must face another year alone, a year without hearing her name, without seeing herself reflected in anyone's eyes, without a night's respite from this curse, a year or 5 or 10, and she realizes then how much she's leaned on it, the promise of his presence, because without it, she is falling. She sinks to the floor among the ruins of her night. It will be years before she sees the sea, the waves crashing against the jagged white cliffs, and then she will remember Luke's goading words. Even rocks wear away to nothing. Addie falls asleep just after dawn, but it is fitful and brief and full of nightmares, and when she wakes to see the sun high over Paris, she cannot bring herself to rise. She sleeps all the day and half the night, and when she wakes, the shattered thing in her has set again, like a badly broken bone, some softness hardened. Enough, she tells herself, rising to her feet. Enough, she repeats, feasting on the bread, now stale, the cheese wilted from the heat. Enough. There will be other dark nights, of course, other wretched dawns, and her resolve will always weaken a little as the days grow long and the anniversary draws near and treacherous hope slips in like a draft. But the sorrow has faded, replaced by stubborn rage, and she resolves to kindle it, to shield and nurture the flame until it takes far more than a single breath to blow it out.